Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we're tackling a subject, almost everyone thinks they know something about: English literature.
Mm-hmm.
You hear that phrase and you probably picture, you know, a certain set of books, mostly old, mostly British.
Right. Often mostly male authors too.
Exactly. Shakespeare, Austen, Dickens, that kind of thing. But what if that whole traditional idea is, well, completely out of date? What if the reality today is way more complex, more global, and frankly, more exciting?
That's precisely the angle Jonathan Bate takes in his book. We're using his English literature, a very short introduction, as our guide today. And it's not really a history book in the usual sense.
Not like a timeline of kings and battles and books you feel guilty about not reading.
Exactly. It's more like a critical toolbox. It helps you understand how literature works, why certain books become famous, and what this whole English literature thing is fundamentally.
Okay, so the mission here isn't just listing books. It's challenging a basic assumption. What's Bate's big idea, the one that sort of changes how we should look at it?
Bate argues pretty strongly that we need to stop thinking of English literature as, you know, a fixed national story. Instead, he says it's a dynamic, constantly argued over global conversation.
Glavel, how so?
The key shift is from geography to language. If it's written in English, Bate says, it's English literature, full stop.
Ah, okay.
And that immediately breaks it free from just England, right?
Yeah.
It makes it this worldwide thing. So, yeah, we're diving in to unpack that, the really profound shift in thinking. Hashtag tag I, the author and the foundational challenge.
All right, before we start dismantling definitions, maybe tell us a bit about Jonathan Bate himself. He's got the credentials for this kind of argument, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. This is Sir Jonathan Bate, knighted for his work in literary scholarship.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, he's a senior research fellow at Oxford. He's considered, you know, one of the top experts globally on Shakespeare, on the Romantics. His authority is pretty immense.
And what makes his approach good for, well, for us, for a general audience?
I think it's his knack for boiling down really complex academic stuff without using tons of jargon. He also brings in newer perspectives, like he was a pioneer in eco-criticism.
Gotcha.
Basically looking at how literature connects with the environment. So he's got this broad modern view. He's really well placed to talk about where the study of literature is actually heading.
Okay, so let's unpack his main challenge, the language thing. We need to sort of break apart the word English.
Mm-hmm.
Why stop thinking geographically?
Well, because history itself makes that old definition kind of impossible to maintain. Bate really pushes the linguistic definition. If it's in English, it counts. Doesn't matter where the author's from or where the story happens.
Right, because if you limit it to just England,
you have to ignore centuries of amazing writing.
And you hit that four nations problem straight away, don't you? Even within the British Isles.
Precisely. Even close to home, you know, loads of foundational figures weren't technically English. Jonathan Swift, Irish Dean, wrote Gulliver's Travels.
Classic.
Robert Burns, Scotland's national poet. Dylan Thomas, Welsh. Often their work is actually pushing against English power centers. So you have to include them, but it immediately messes up the simple English England idea.
And then it gets even bigger, right? The whole global spread.
Mm.
English gets exported sometimes pretty brutally through colonialism.
Mm.
But then writers in those places take the language and, well, they make it their own. They transform it.
Yes. And that's key. Bate says the creative energy, the heart of English literature now is fundamentally decentered. It's not just London anymore. You trace the language leaving Britain, setting up in America, but then really exploding in the post-colonial world. India, Africa, the Caribbean, the literature coming out of there is just phenomenal.
So the language itself, the tool of empire, gets turned back on the empire.
Absolutely. You read someone like Chinua Achebe from Nigeria or Salman Rushdie writing from an Indian perspective. They're using English to tell stories and share viewpoints that were basically ignored or suppressed by the empire before. So English literature isn't a monologue from England anymore. It's a dialogue in English happening all over the world. And yeah, that just makes it so much richer, so much more relevant today. Hashtag tag two, the system's core components.
Okay, so if it's decentered, if it's global,
mm-hmm,
what holds it together? Why even call it one thing? Bate spends a lot of time on Shakespeare. Why him? If it's all global now, why keep this, you know, 16th century English guy right at the center? Isn't that just swapping nationalism for, like, hero worship?
That's a really fair question, and Bate sees it coming. His argument is that Shakespeare is indispensable, but not really because he was English. It's about his unbelievable creativity with the language itself and his universality.
How so? Universality.
Well, he didn't just write famous plays. He basically invented or made popular thousands of words and phrases we still use every single day. He's baked into the language.
Ah, okay. So he's like an anchor for the language, not the nation state.
That's a good way to put it. And he covers everything, right? Tragedy, comedy, history, romance. With this incredible psychological depth that just, it still speaks to us now across cultures. His stuff gets translated, adapted, wrestled with everywhere English is written. So if you need one reference point that connects almost everyone writing in English,
it's probably Shakespeare.
It's probably Shakespeare.
So that makes more sense. And that brings up another point Bate makes about form, the way something is written. Mm-hmm. He argues it's not just a box you put the story in. The form itself shapes the meaning. Can we quickly break down the main forms he talks about?
Yeah, absolutely crucial. The choice of genre, it kind of sets the rules of the game. So first, you've got poetry. This is language used in a heightened way. Think rhythm, sound, patterns, really packing meaning into fewer words.
Like music with words.
Kind of. And Bate points to two main types. There's the epic long, grand narratives about nations or myths. Milton's Paradise Lost is the classic example, trying to explain, you know, everything.
Big scope.
Huge scope. Then there's the lyric, shorter, much more personal, subjective, capturing a feeling, a moment. Think Wordsworth, I wandered lonely as a cloud. It's about the inner experience, not the giant history. That shift itself tells you something about cultural changes.
Okay. Then drama.
Right. Drama is written specifically to be performed. It relies on dialogue, actors, an audience reacting right there. So it needs to be immediate, compressed. The big classical types are tragedy, think downfall of a great figure.
Lear, Macbeth.
Exactly. And comedy, usually about sorting out social messes, often ending with a marriage or a party. It's very much a social art form.
And the last one, the big one for the last few centuries, the novel.
The long story in prose. Bate connects its rise in the 18th century directly to more people, especially the middle class, learning to read and having the time and maybe the privacy to sit with a long book.
Right. You need leisure time for a novel.
You do. And its superpower is its ability to do detailed social realism, capturing everyday life, class, manners, like Jane Austen does brilliantly, and also psychological depth, getting right inside a character's head. It's really the art form that defines modernity in many ways. #33, literature's active role in history and culture.
Now, this is where it gets really interesting for me. Bate argues literature isn't just a mirror reflecting history. He says it actually makes history, or at least shapes our understanding of it. It creates cultural identity.
Yeah, he uses Shakespeare's history plays as a prime example. Think about Henry V. Bate says plays like that were absolutely vital in forging a sense of English national identity, a shared story about heroism, destiny.
Like propaganda, almost.
Yeah.
But more complex.
Well, maybe myth-making is a better term. Literature acts like a forge, he says. It takes the messy, fragmented bits of the past and hammers them into a coherent, powerful story. It gives a culture the narratives it tells itself about who it is.
Okay, so if literature is actively making these myths, and the old geographical lines don't hold, then this idea of the literary canon, the list of great books, that must be pretty shaky, too.
Totally shaky. Bate really works to demystify the canon. He's very clear. It's not some sacred list passed down from on high.
Not handed down by literary angels.
Definitely not. It's a human thing, a cultural process built over centuries by choices. Choices made by critics, teachers, publishers. It's basically how a culture decides what's important enough to keep talking about and pass on.
So how does he describe it now? Is it just collapsing?
No, not collapsing. He uses this great analogy. The canon is like a noisy and perpetual parliamentary debate.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it's never finished. It's always being argued over. And those challenges we've seen, especially from feminist critics, post-colonial critics, demanding more diversity, Bate says that's not destroying the canon. That is the canon. It's keeping the debate alive, forcing us to ask tough questions like, whose stories have we been ignoring?
Okay, so the list is always changing, always being debated. How then do we figure out literary value? Is it just, I like this book, you don't? Purely subjective.
Bate pushes back against pure subjectivity. He says judging value is complicated, sure, but it's not just random opinion. He offers some criteria we can use to argue why a book might have lasting value.
Like what?
Things like formal complexity and originality, just the sheer skill, the craft, the way language is used in a new way. Then there's truth to life. Does the work offer some deep, recognizable insight into being human, something that still resonates.
That makes sense. It feels true, even if it's old.
Exactly. Also, moral or intellectual depth and its historical significance, how much impact did it have on later writers or on culture? The key thing, Bait argues, isn't having the right list. It's the act of defending these judgments, explaining why you think something is valuable. That's what real criticism is. Hashtag tag I view. Key takeaways and application for the learner.
Okay, this whole framework really shifts literature from feeling like, I don't know, homework, to something much more active and analytical. So for someone listening, let's boil down Bait's view. What are maybe three core messages to take away?
Right. First, definitely, English literature is fundamentally about language, and it's global, not national. So embrace that huge diversity of voices writing in English from all over the world. Don't just think England.
Got it. Global, linguistic. What's second?
Second, literature isn't just passive reflection. It's an active force, a kind of powerful cultural technology, really, that helps create identity, shape memory, influence how we see things. It's doing work on us.
Okay, active force. And third?
Third, that idea of the literary canon.
Yeah.
It's a dynamic, human-made conversation. It's always changing, always being argued over. There's no final correct list, just an ongoing discussion about what matters.
Right, active, global, debated. Mm-hmm. So how does knowing all this actually help someone, you know, in their daily life, beyond just sounding smart about books?
Well, Bait's whole approach, taking something familiar, pulling it apart, showing it's debated, that's basically training in critical thinking.
How so?
If you understand how, say, Henry V helped build a national myth back then, you start recognizing similar patterns now. In politics, in advertising, in the news, you see how stories are structured to persuade you or make you feel a certain way. It makes you a savvier reader of the world, not just books.
That's really useful. And I was thinking the discussion about judging value that feels relevant to just dealing with information overload today.
Absolutely. That framework for literary value, it's a great model for personal curation. We're flooded with content, right? Articles, movies, social media, Bait's criteria, originality, depth, craft, truth to life. You can adapt those. Ask yourself, is this piece of information, this movie, this idea actually worth my time? Does it offer a real insight or is it just noise? It encourages a more active choice.
Yeah, choosing quality over just quantity. What really stuck with me, and maybe the most powerful application, is that idea you mentioned earlier, literature as a sophisticated technology, for understanding what it means to be human. It takes it way beyond just school subject.
Mm-hmm.
Reading a great novel isn't just following a plot. It's like running a simulation, right? Experiencing life from inside someone else's head in a different time or place, wrestling with your choices.
That's it. Exactly. That's the enduring power. It lets us live hundreds of lives, not just our own. It expands our empathy, our understanding, and that core function, exploring human experience through the art of language. Well, that's never going to go out of style. It's why, as Bait suggests, the study of literature is always going to be essential.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.